Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Militia there. At least 40 people were killed as American forces provided air cover to Iraqi troops fighting the Mahdi militia in southern Iraq. And there are reports that militia members executed Iraqi soldiers in the street. Mahdi army leader and Shiite cleric Muqtadir al-Sadr has agreed to stop the fighting for now. Joining us with more from Iraq is Sudarsan Raghavan of the Washington Post. And Sudarsan, the largely Shiite Iraqi leadership has given fellow Shiite Sadr a wide berth in the past. How significant is this latest clash?
Well, it's significant in two different ways. I mean, what we saw yesterday is some of the most fierce clashes we've ever seen between U.S.-backed Iraqi forces and the Mahdi army. It signifies a couple of things. First of all, it really shows the growing confidence and strength of Muqtada Sadr and his army and his militia army. And it also, at the same time, shows how, in a way, the weaknesses faced by the U.S.-backed Iraqi troops, most of the casualties did come from them, and so it raises questions whether they're prepared enough, if the U.S. is preparing them enough to really take over the security situations, which is a key goal of the U.S. military in order to one day leave Iraq.
Well, and we understand that there are reports that the Iraqi soldiers ran out of ammunition, and after that, members of the militias executed them in the public square. There are even reports of some beheadings.
Yes, I mean, we've heard those reports as well. It basically reflects how the Mahdi army is increasingly challenging the Iraqi government and its benefactor, the United States. Even though Muqtada Sadr is part of the government, he definitely poses, as U.S. officials say, significant threat to the stability of Iraq.
We should explain Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki relies on Muqtada al-Sadr for political support, and Sadr controls several ministries, at least 30 parliament seats. You say that this reflects the strength of the militia, but does the fighting yesterday and the fact that the U.S. gave air cover, does that reflect a shift in the thinking?
Well, you said Muqtada Sadr is part of the government, and going after him directly could, in fact, implode Iraq even more so. But at the same time, there are growing tensions between U.S. troops and forces of Sadr. Meanwhile, there are other militias as well in Iraq who are, as of now, as of this moment, kind of watching from the sidelines to see what happens. So the U.S. Publicly is not saying that they are going after Sadr. In fact, they are saying publicly that they are going after any death squads because they want to bring the rule of law to Iraq.
Do you think that the gains that may have been achieved in the past few months with more troops in the area have been eroded?
The U.S. military is definitely focused predominantly on Baghdad now and trying to clean up several neighborhoods in Baghdad. What yesterday's clashes underscore is that Shiite-dominated South is becoming another sort of flashpoint that could become even worse than the chaos that's unfolding in Baghdad.
Sudarsan Raghavan of The Washington Post speaking to us from Baghdad. Sudarsan, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
It's August 29th, the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina slamming into the Gulf Coast. At least 1,500 people were killed, homes were destroyed, entire neighborhoods wiped out, hundreds of thousands of people forced into a diaspora, settled uneasily still across the country. Today, a year on, we'll hear voices from New Orleans. Half that city has electricity, half of its hospitals remain closed, violent crime is up, less than half the population has returned. One man who stayed, Jacques Morial, an African-American, both his father and brother were past mayors. A former investment banker, he's now living off savings and sales of artwork. He's become a community activist, committed to getting New Orleans back on track. And Jacques Morial, how would you sum up the city one year later?
Oh, full of struggles and challenges.
Yeah.
It's a struggle to live every day, and we're faced with challenges to recovery and rebuilding, but there's a glimmers of hope across the city.
Well, give us some examples of the challenges. I mean, day-to-day living, what you might go to do that we would take for granted and you realize you can't.
Lots of things have not changed much since a few weeks after the storm. There are still large sections of the city without streetlights. The infrastructure in the city, the drainage, the sewage, and the freshwater system is still crippled. And lots of people, including myself, still have substantial damages to their home. My home did not flood. All the water in my home came through the roof. But I was very fortunate.
Do I understand you have one dry room where you live?
Yeah, I have one dry room where I live. It's dry. It's damp often, but it's dry.
Everything's relative, I suppose, now.
Yes.
Well, what do you think about some of the conspiracy theories that we're hearing about, especially with the Spike Lee's movie that just came out? There are some people who feel that the levees were purposefully blown up to remove the largely African-American population from the areas that were flooded. And we're going to be talking to Tulane University professor Doug Brinkley, mm-hmm. who feels that it may not have been a conspiracy, but a side effect of the inaction of anyone, you know, rebuilding New Orleans, is that the African-American community has been largely removed.
That certainly has been the effect. But so far as the flood protection system being sabotaged, I personally have not seen any direct and convincing evidence of that. At the same time, I certainly understand how people might believe that for a few reasons, rooted in history. In 1927, the Great Flood of the Mississippi River, the levees were blown up, and parts of New Orleans and St. Bernard Parish, which is southeast of New Orleans, were intentionally flooded to save the city. And then in 1965, when Hurricane Betsy struck New Orleans and flooded the Lower Ninth Ward, there were lots of fears and discussion that the levees may have been sabotaged and the Lower Nine sacrificed to save some wealthier and whiter sections of the city. Those fears were never investigated and never proven or disproven. Fast forward to last year. I was here in New Orleans, and the morning that the storm hit, I heard at least a dozen explosions from where I was, close to downtown. I know for a fact that some of them were electrical transformers blowing up. And I know in one case there was a tank car that exploded near the river. So lots of people heard these explosions. They've been informed by history. And the water rose so quickly that most people dismissed it, that it could be a natural phenomenon. All of that being said, I think it is fair, and I think few would argue that perhaps the levees were not sabotaged, but there certainly was a slow fuse that was burning for decades before.
Jacques Morial, we understand that prior to Hurricane Katrina, you worked as a public relations person for several local organizations that no longer exist because of the flood, because of Katrina. So what do you do now, and why do you stay?
I stay because, I'm gonna die and be buried here. I stay because I'm not going to surrender to the forces of nature, nor the forces of government indifference. I refuse to. And I stay because my neighbors and fellow citizens need help. We've got to work together. We've been involved in everything from public health, public housing and affordable housing, neighborhood planning, criminal justice. All of these sorts of institutions and systems are crippled here, if at all existing now.
Jacques Morial, a resident of New Orleans who's determined to stay in the wake of Katrina. Jacques, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for being interested in our struggle.
Well, Barbara Pond also decided to stay in the New Orleans area for now. She's facing tremendous challenges trying to reclaim her life and her home in St. Bernard Parish, which is adjacent to the Ninth Ward. And she joins us from the law office where she works in the city. And Barbara, I understand you evacuated to Orlando, where your daughter lives, before Katrina hit, but you're back. And boy, I'm reading through a series of, you know, staying with friends, staying in hotels. Are you finally back in your home?
No, I am not. I am in a FEMA trailer in the area of my home that has been gutted, and it took me about 7 months to get into that FEMA trailer, but I'm happy as a clam in it, I have to say.
Because
I have one place to call home now. I don't have to pick up and move every 2 or 3 weeks. I don't have to live in a hotel.
Which you did. But you say happy as a clam, but yet I'm understanding that your home, which is destroyed, It was insured. You had flood insurance, but that can't possibly cover your full mortgage, which was paid.
My mortgage was paid, correct.
So what does that mean for you?
The pre-Katrina dollars that I got will not get me another home of the type that I had. So I am going to have to take out another mortgage in order to be able to buy another home or to redo my home.
If you don't mind my saying, a 56-year-old woman, great age, but divorced, a daughter, are you prepared to go back to work to pay for a home?
Well, I am working, mm-hmm. and I guess I will continue to work, I guess, until I'm in my grave, because I intend to have another home. I intend to be happy, whether it's here in New Orleans or elsewhere. I am going to rebuild somewhere.
Well, you know, we hear about all the services that are missing in New Orleans. We're going to be talking more about that over the coming days. And we're also hearing that there's something called evacuee fatigue. The people are, and there's Hurricane Katrina fatigue. And I'm wondering, are you feeling a little of that? Are you, you know, able to stay in the city the way it is now?
I am right now, but for the long haul, I don't believe that I want to. I probably could. I could muster up the strength to do it, but I also want to be happy. And right now, my neighbors have not returned. My closest friends have moved on to other cities. Crime has gone up. I'm still afraid of the levees that they supposedly have rebuilt.
It's hurricane season. How are you feeling?
I have a bag packed, and I'm ready to go at a moment's notice.
Yeah. We have a little over a minute left, Barbara. I'm just wondering, could you just tick off some of the things that we might not think of that you miss, from a service to a thing that you had, I mean, you know, a year later?
Well, hot water. My trailer has warm water. Running water at all. There's still areas of my neighborhood where there is none. But I miss restaurants. How about a McDonald's? We have no McDonald's in the St. Bernard area. We don't have a grocery store. We have a small little 7-Eleven type operation where we can go and get some things.
Yeah.
And they keep promising that these facilities will be there, but it's a year later and we haven't gotten them yet.
Barbara Pons works in the IT department of a law firm, speaking to us from her office in New Orleans while she lives in a trailer. Happy as a clam and yet, you know, missing a lot of things a year after Katrina. Barbara, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, just ahead, another resident of New Orleans who also happens to be best-selling author and Tulane professor Doug Brinkley. He'll talk about the political side effects of Katrina, how he sees it. Much more coming up here and now. His comments in Frank Rich's column in this past Sunday's New York Times jumped out at us, and he joins us on the line. Doug Brinkley, you refer to the president's strategy on New Orleans as deliberate inaction. Can you explain that?
The Bush administration's sense of lagging behind or not helping the Lower Ninth or Lakeview or New Orleans East or Gentilly rebuild, it's purposeful. It's not just, oh gosh, the bureaucrats are slow. The bureaucrats don't want to see the below sea level parts of New Orleans rebuild. Hence, it's a phony policy right now. We don't have a rebuild New Orleans policy. We have a death by attrition for a number of neighborhoods.
But why would they do that?
The money's not there. New Orleans is below sea level. If you don't pump billions of dollars into wetlands restoration and rebuild the barrier islands, then every day the Gulf of Mexico gets closer to the gates of New Orleans. We're losing 2 football fields of land a day. Second, the levee system, we fixed these 3 breaches, but the entire over 300-mile levee system is stressed. It's the Army Corps of Engineers is telling the residents it's not safe. The floodgates aren't safe. The pump houses aren't built. given that scenario, the Bush administration and Reagan administration basically have decided, let's say one thing, come on back if you want to, gut your own house, but how can you live in a neighborhood that has no electricity, no water, garbage everywhere? It's impossible.
Well, Douglas Brinkley, let me hold you up right there, because others have said that, in fact, if New Orleans is rebuilt, it should be a smaller city because of just some of the problems that you've mentioned, because of the levee, because of the coast, because of the weather. But you go on to say that that's not the reason behind what you perceive as inaction in rebuilding New Orleans. You make a very serious charge that, yes, the destination is a smaller city, but for the purpose of not allowing the black population back, why?
Well, that's not the sole reason. That's just the net effect of what's happened. We've lost through about 300,000 African Americans from New Orleans, which are largely Democratic voters. They've dispersed in the state of Louisiana. It's a 50-50 state. It's been purple. We have one Democratic Senator, Mary Landrieu, a Democratic governor. The loss of New Orleans is turning Louisiana into a Republican red state. That's just been a side effect of it. Also, the reconstruction money coming into town is largely through Republican companies in the South. So if you're looking a year later, what's happened, the Bush policy has turned Louisiana, by not rebuilding those neighborhoods, keeps it as a Republican state. Contracts are coming in to Republican-friendly companies. And meanwhile, they know the monies aren't there to rebuild the whole levees or deal with wetlands restoration. So you do the bare minimum to get a pass, which has been done.
Well, what are you saying, Douglas Brinkley? Because you began by saying that the inaction is the action, it's the policy.
Right.
You say a side effect is a smaller city with a large portion of the black, largely Democratic voters scattered across the country.
Right.
And as you said to Frank Rich, in effect, the last blue state in the Old South is turning into a red state.
Yes.
Do you think that was the goal? Are you actually saying that that's a planned side effect?
Well, it's a reality. Now, for some people, that's good news. I, as somebody who cares about the cultural heritage of the Lower Ninth, which is to me an African-American mecca, do feel that we need to have some kind of plan to rebuild. It doesn't matter what you feel. Let's just be honest to the people. If you really don't want people to come back, and we're not going to rebuild these neighborhoods, then let's have the political courage to just say so.
But Douglas Brinkley, why would the Democratic governor and Democratic mayor of Louisiana participate in this?
You're making a bigger deal out of what I'm saying. It's just a reality. Everybody in America knows it. We've lost 300,000 Democratic voters. New Orleans has lost the black constituency that left here. Voted Democratic, it's a fact. Why do you want to object to that?
Well, it would just because it does sound, you know.
Well, but it's a fact.
Yeah, it's a fact.
You know, I mean, that's what's happened. Do I think President Bush or the Bush administration wants people to suffer? No. It's very hard to tell people not to come back to their communities. It's better just to death by attrition. You don't have to make a big policy action paper. We're not going to rebuild the neighborhood. Just don't provide services so people can't come back.
In your book, you detail page after page, hundreds of pages, over 600 pages of bureaucratic incompetence. The comments that you made to Frank Rich, and I'm just going to give you another opportunity to address this, which you have, but just to once again address it, almost make it sound, I mean, I'll quote you, out of the Katrina debacle, Bush is making political gains. The last blue state in the Old South is turning into a red state. You're not, though, switching from bureaucratic incompetence to political brilliance.
Well, it's not political brilliance. It's just it's a side effect of what happened. You know, in life, you have to kind of score where you're at it sometimes. So a year later, with President Bush in the region, people are looking to say, okay, what's happened here politically in the state of Louisiana? And what's happened is it's become a red state, and that the businesses here are red state businesses that have come in to rebuild. That's part of the rebuild plan for the Republicans.
Well, Douglas Brinkley, here we are at the first anniversary. Given your feeling that your city is disappearing in the way that you knew it and the way that you think it should be, as you said, what do you do? So what's to be done?
What we do is you have to have national leadership. I have three children. Would you recommend that I stay here, given the situation in New Orleans with three kids? I want to. I love the city. It's home. But if we can't have a levee system, that means every hurricane season where we're going to get wiped out, it makes it very hard to live here. So by not acting, by inaction, the action is to make it a smaller city.
A smaller city and a more Republican city.
No, it's the state. You know how many states in this country now are like 50-50. Pre-Katrina, that was Louisiana. Post-Katrina, it's a Republican state.
Douglas Brinkley is the author of The Great Deluge, Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans, and the Mississippi Gulf Coast. He's also professor of history at Tulane University and a resident of New Orleans. Doug Brinkley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this note, tomorrow we'll have the effect of Katrina on seniors. An elder care worker says that one year on, they're dying earlier than they might because of their grief over the loss of their city. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K to 12 nationwide. MOS.org.
Person is an outspoken critic of the administration and is staging a protest against its policies tomorrow, when the president will follow his defense secretary to the city to attend a fundraiser and to address the annual convention of the American Legion on Thursday. Utah is a deeply red state, which still gives President Bush his highest approval ratings, but Salt Lake is a Democratic enclave in that sea of red, and Mayor Anderson also led a protest against the president last summer. This year, he's upped the ante a bit by inviting people like Cindy Sheehan to join him, and Republicans have responded by organizing a demonstration of their own. Well, joining us now from his home in Salt Lake is Mayor Rocky Anderson. Mr. Mayor, why are you doing this?
I think everyone who has heartfelt concerns about our nation at this very dangerous time needs to do everything that we can to express our opposition. And that is especially true for anybody in a leadership position. We have a president who has utter disdain for our nation's fundamental constitutional principles. A president who makes excuses for torturing other human beings, for holding people for years without bringing charges against them, and then, of course, ordering unconstitutional warrantless wiretapping of American citizens. And then, worst of all, I think, is lying to the American people about Saddam Hussein building a nuclear capability, about having chemical and biological weapons, as an excuse to rush into war directly in contravention of international law.
Well, Mayor Anderson, having just spent a week in the Salt Lake area, I know that this is very much the talk of the town, and you're someone who has expressed your opinions about this. You've got supporters, but even people who agree with your thinking about the Bush administration have been critical of you. Bridgeport, Connecticut Mayor John Fabrizi, for instance, hosted President Bush recently, even though he also disagrees with President Bush's policies. And his office says, you know, the mayor's job is to be a gracious host, to honor the office of the president. What about that criticism of you, that, you know, you're supposed to represent all the people?
Well, frankly, I think that is symptomatic of what's become a real culture of obedience around this country. People wanting to be polite, people being afraid of standing up and telling the truth. I expect to be civil about it. I expect to be reasonable about it. But I also insist that we tell the truth.
But, Mr. Mayor, what about your constituents who, you know, expect to represent them? I'm thinking of Mike Parkin. He's the senior vice commander of the VFW's Atomic Post 4355 in Salt Lake. He says the protest is unpatriotic and despicable, and he voted for you, and he expected you to represent him.
I am a great patriot. I love our country, and I have the values. I've internalized these values. I've worked for these values all my adult life, the values that underlie our Constitution.
But I guess the point of that comment of that constituent goes to the biggest question that people have. I mean, if the president were not coming to address a veterans group, you might, it would seem, have some more supporters. What do you think of the people who say, and I'm thinking your editorial was side by side with one from Paul T. Miro, president of Salt Lake City's conservative Sutherland Institute, and he says that this is particularly insulting, the idea of a protest, because it's veterans who are meeting, and that a protest is stepping on the graves of heroes.
We support our troops to the point that we don't think that they should ever have been put in harm's way. And we're very grateful to our veterans for sacrificing so much to provide us with the freedom to be able to stand up and oppose our government.
Why don't more Utahns agree with you? According to a poll in the Salt Lake Tribune, 45% of the poll respondents said that war protesters such as Cindy Sheehan and yourself aid U.S. enemies. Only 27% embraced your view. And Democrats were split. Not a clear majority agreed with the protest.
I'm not here in any sense, whether as a human being, a member of my community, as mayor of Salt Lake City, just to slap everybody on the back and be polite and be a gracious host. Life is not about ceremony. It is about trying to find out the facts, determine what's right and wrong, and stand up when we see that things are going so very, very wrong in our country.
Rocky Anderson, mayor of Salt Lake City, he's going to be leading a protest against the policies of the Bush administration. President Bush heading to the Salt Lake area tomorrow and Thursday. Mr. Mayor, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, the mayor had plenty of support over at the Holiday United Church of Christ this past Sunday. Admittedly, this is one of the few progressive ministries in Salt Lake, but still, the first hymn was a fiery one. Lead us from death to life, still all the angry guns. It's funny, when I set off for Utah on vacation, I didn't think it would be such a news hotspot. Utah's about fun. When you arrive at the airport, you're enveloped in a big community hug, whole extended families with signs and balloons waiting at the gate. Of course, they're welcoming home young relatives from the 2-year mission required of devout Mormons. But still, the spillover feels nice. In northern Utah, where the president will be, the Wasatch Mountains rim Salt Lake Valley like a pack of big friendly dogs, seeming to say, come on, let's go hiking. Down south, on the border with Arizona, it's more foreboding. This is canyon country, home to Bryce and Zion National Parks. Crazy buttes rise thousands of feet in the air. Picture the movies Rio Grande, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or Thelma and Louise. These movies were made here because this is where, as John Wayne said, God put the West. I am an East Coast girl, where rivers are green with algae and lily pads. In Utah, the Green River runs brown with silt, but feels crystal clear. And in the 4 days we spent alternately rafting and swimming 68 miles, we saw exactly 2 beavers, 1 lizard, and a blue heron. There was no talk of news. There was no sound at all, save for paddle on water and 1 terrific thunderstorm. Other than that, nothing. In such majestic silence, conversations bounce rudely off the Navajo sandstone canyon walls like a novice at the opera. Did we bring any mayo, 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 mayo? If the Wasatch Mountains were playful sheepdogs, what, we wondered, were these red cliffs saying? They're reproachful, I thought. Oh, no, my friend said. They're just keeping mum like cloistered monks. Well, I got my answer last Sunday while visiting that church in Holiday. In the middle of a medley from the wonderful guest choir, the Golden Voices Gospel Ensemble, I heard the line, you'll run to the rocks to hide your face. The rocks are going to cry out, uh-uh, this is no hiding place. There's no hiding place down here. No hiding place. The president is coming to Utah. Time for me to leave and get back to work.
No hiding place down here.
Down here.
There's no hiding place down here. Down here.
Down here.
No hiding place on the mountain. No hiding place in the waters. No hiding place down here. Yeah, I went to the rock to hide my face, but the rock cried out, no hiding place. There's no hiding place down here.
Speaking of which, no hiding place, there's news today that the leader of a polygamist Mormon sect, one of the FBI's 10 most wanted, was arrested last night outside of Las Vegas. 50-year-old Warren Jeffs was arrested during a traffic stop. He's accused of arranging marriages between underage girls and older men. Jeffs is the head of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS, which has 6,000 members on the Utah-Colorado border. The FLDS split from the mainstream Mormon church more than 100 years ago, after the Mormons denounced polygamy. Flora Jessup is a former member of the FLDS. She fled that church after she says she was forced into marriage at the age of 16. She now helps other women who want to leave. And Flora, what was your reaction when you heard the news today?
I was both elated and frightened at the same time.
Why frightened?
While Warren Jeffs was on the run, there's a level of caution with the community that kept the violence in check. With him being captured, there's nothing to stop any violence from erupting with these guys.
And what do you mean by violence? I mean, we should say, you know, HBO has that popular series Big Love about polygamy families. And if you watch that, you see that there is violence from some of the heads of some of the families against those who would act out. What do you mean by violence?
Well, Warren Jeffs has had over 1,000 boys in training for the last several years as his personal army. I worked with one of these 14-year-old boys for a couple of years, and this boy was taught that it was going to be mandatory that these boys defend the prophet to the death. That's been very frightening for us, the fact that Warren Jeffs has declared that he would be the last prophet on the earth before the next coming. And when you look back through the history of polygamy, there's violent nature throughout the history of this belief system.
So do you feel that you, as someone who's left the church and has been outspoken against, again, fundamentalist branch of Mormons, do you feel that you won't be safe?
I'm not worried about my safety. I'm worried about the safety of my family members that are still inside. I've been dealing with the threats from these people for several years, and it's just something that comes with the territory.
Well, we should say that Jeffs is charged with performing a ceremonial marriage involving a 16-year-old girl. This is back in 2002. He knew the girl was under 18 when he performed this marriage, which, by the way, is not recorded by law.
Basically, is statutory rape or child sexual abuse.
Well, how many others of those marriages are there, do you think?
Hundreds. The youngest known marriage we know of up there is 8 years old.
And what is it about Jeffs that's so charismatic? Just tell us a little more about him.
Well, he's a very soft-spoken man. That's the thing with most of the males in this culture is the men are very soft spoken, but they believe it's the American Taliban. These guys completely believe that they are fighting for God, that God has commanded them to do this. How do you stop? It's like having the terrorists on the streets of America.
Flora Jessup, again, a former member of this fundamentalist branch of Mormonism that believes in polygamy, as the prophet, the head of this church and a huge family, has been arrested today. And I just want to quickly ask you, Flora, this comes as there was news last week in Salt Lake City that a group of children of polygamists had almost a press conference, a rally, defending their lifestyle. How pervasive and how accepted is it?
Well, you know, in regards to that march of the pro-polygamous children, I think it's very ironic that you have a bunch of people that claim we don't force our children to live polygamy, and yet they've got all their 8-year-old children out there marching with signs saying, we want the freedom to live polygamy.
Yeah.
You know, 8-year-old children don't have the ability to discern what they want to live as a religious choice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, if they had the ability to discern things like that, we would give them a driver's license and let them vote.
Flora Jessup, again, a former member of FLDS, fled the church after she says she was forced into a marriage at the age of 16 and now helps other women who want to leave the church. The church leader arrested today in Las Vegas. Flora, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Katrina hit. Ronnie has written an essay about what he went through a year ago today, and he recorded it for New Orleans public radio station WWNO. What follows are a few excerpts from Ronnie Virgit's story. It's called 3 Days of Katrina.
Mostly, nature can be ignored. So it is. Then, on some dark and stormy night, nature comes to call. Now, nature clucks. I have your full attention, and watch, little ones. Watch and learn. This was it. A hurricane. One of those globs of green and yellow that the TV weathermen dance around excitedly. Only now it was here. The winds throttled the trees, paused, throttled them again. They cuffed the house like a fat man jumping up and down on your bumper. The narcotic of television helped keep his mind off of things. Then, the electricity went out. At some point, he looked back outside. This time, he saw water. Rib water. Journeying water. Water in a hurry to be somewhere else. It was already to his first step, and an hour later, second step. The houses across the street huddled together in resigned surrender like pups left at the pound by tired-out masters. Everywhere wires roiled and dangled, the civilized spaghetti that usually brought things convenient and communicative, now the hazardous and haphazardous. A look up with sleep-besotted eyes and moving along the maze of wires and treetops. A thing dark-skinned with a tail that is blinking light? Ah, no. What's being watched is a helicopter. Now that the deluge is past, the air is busy with rescuers and recorders looking down on those who now want them. And those will soon begin their victims' dance. Waving towels, displaying entreating bedsheets, looking skyward with pleading eyes. All trying to win approval, enough approval that you would be permitted to continue living. Here comes one now. Wave that towel, crane that neck, try to make eye contact. Throw something, Mr. Pilot, a rope ladder, or at least a look. Throw me something, mister. Me. The water in the stairwell has come up another couple of steps during the night. Time, maybe past time, to start making getaway plans. He fished a broom out of the water and swung it against the wall until the head broke off. Then he brought it upstairs and hunted for hammer and nails till he found them. It was hard to write something on the bedsheet. He decided on what he had always been told was the first sentence he had ever uttered after some hide-and-seek. Here I is. There was something symmetrical and existential, too, about it. So he scratched, "Here I is," on the bedsheet and nailed it to the broomstick. As he struggled to fix the broomstick to the house front, he heard a shout, like a man calling for hunting dogs. He heard himself shouting back. The boat slowly came. 2 young men were standing, and he could see the tops of 2 older heads. "Glad to see you. Would you mind waiting for me to get some pants?" One of the young men covered his mouth in mock horror. "By all means," he said. He dressed as fast as he could. It's not wise to keep redemption waiting. The 2 young men in the boat were named Eric and Johnny, and that's all he would know of them, maybe ever. Finally, the black waters yielded to the concrete high of the interstate, and here the rescue airboat scraped to a stop. "Start walking," a man in uniform softly suggested, and he did. It was a good long walk. and then he was among the heat and anguish of what was called a triage area at Causeway in the interstate. Then, mercifully, school buses from Ascension Parish. Or was it Assumption? Where you headed? Nichols University in Thibodaux. Get in. When filled, the buses began. He softly leaned his cheek against the quivering bus window and closed his eyes. He hoped some calm would come, but instead a headache rippled through his scalp, helped along by the clamor of the scared and stupid. Sleep would be such a gift. He felt it far off and getting further. The convoy stopped in a big parking lot outside Shaver Auditorium. Crowds milled around relentlessly. Without electricity, workers took down names by Coleman lanterns. Families staked out sleep spots on the gym floor. It was hot. Outside, the gym was cooler. Herds of cell phone addicts walked here and there trying to make a connection, but none seemed to work. A young woman sat on the curb and fixed another young woman's hair. "We gotta keep keeping on," she said to someone. When he finally comes back by car to the house he left by boat. The woman from a few houses down came by. Her face was like a baby that's just fallen hard and can easily cry, but wants a second opinion and is looking into your face for one. She just held her arms open as she walked up and down and then put them around him and sobbed against his chest. "I'm almost afraid to say this," she whispered. "But I didn't feel this bad when my daddy died." And this didn't seem at all odd to say, because when your daddy dies, people rally around you in tiny support groups until you think of something else. But now, it's as if everybody's daddy has died, all on one awful day.
Ronnie Virgit's home is still being renovated. He's currently living in the same part of New Orleans. His essay, 3 Days of Katrina, was originally produced by WWNO's program director, Fred Kasten, who also wrote and performed most of the score. It airs tonight in its entirety on that station as part of their Katrina 9 Live special. You can listen online, or for more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Rebuilding Tulane University after Katrina. We'll have the view from the president's office. Also, author and Dr. Robin Cook on concierge medicine. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News.